Welcome to episode 445 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Michael O'Malley,
Paige Collier,
Seth Troyer,
aka Mrs. Jonathan Brisby.
Yes, Mr. Ages.
Today's episode, we're going to be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we're going to be kicking off our Don Bluth series with 1982's The Secret of Nim. Get into some nice rat action. Paige.
Damn, we're starting at the peak.
I love rat action.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah. His career is kind of like a downward slope, unfortunately.
I feel like I only come on the podcast to talk about rats, actually.
What was the last rat?
Ratatouille.
Oh, cool. That one rules.
I'm like, rats and gays, I'm in. And then that's it. And then I peace out for a year.
That movie made me
We need a rat series. So yeah.
No. We need
rats.
A rats and gays series. And then
yes,
the page,
absolutely.
Paige, program a rats and gays series. We'll do it.
I'm on it.
Mouse Hunt? Does that count? It doesn't
that
count.
Absolutely counts. You're so right.
Okay. Mouse Hunt so is right. Amazing. God. I couldn't believe how good
Thank
that
you.
Was.
Thank you. You're right. It
re-watch.
Is.
It feels like
that's
it's
one of those movies
by
that
the Amelie guy or something. It's like, or Terry Gilliam.
No, it's isn't it? It's Gore Verbinski.
Yeah, I was gonna say, isn't it Gore Verbinski?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It's the Pirates of the Caribbean guy.
Oh wow, man. Okay. Wow.
I
was really nice to that guy all of a sudden.
He's good. I like Gore Verbinski.
I believe it. I don't know. It's been
cool.
It's been a while.
Obsessed with water.
Mouse Hunt was one of those movies that I saw. I always remember seeing the cover of in Blockbuster growing up. And then like as an adult, I like ran across it again. I was like, it's that movie that I always saw in Blockbuster but never got. I don't know if you guys have movies like that where like as a kid they kind of loomed large in your mind, but you never actually sat down and watched them.
Mine was Jawbreaker. Was obsessed with the cover of Jawbreaker. Never
what
watched
it. What could
it
be about?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you since?
No.
You want to wreck it? It won't be as good as what it's in your head.
Are there gays or rats in there?
That's, yeah.
That's my criteria, sorry.
Are you a movie? Do you have a gay or a rat in it? I'm not watching. Anyway, so transition. I don't know how to transition out of that.
Bing bong, bing bong.
I've got a good transition to the movie I'm supposed to talk about, which has a gay in it.
Go for it, go for it.
Yeah. So I watched The Whale, which is the latest movie directed by Darren Aronofsky and starring Brendan Fraser in a role that won him an Oscar, I believe, right? He won an Oscar? Yeah, for best leading actor, right?
Was it leading actor?
Was it? Hold on. I should have looked this up, but I'll look it up while I'm talking. But at any rate, The Whale is about Brendan Fraser, who is an English teacher, but because of things in his past that we learn as the movie unfolds, he has like basically secluded himself in his house, at least in part because of his issues with weight gain, which have like severely limited his mobility. And at the beginning of the movie, we find out that he's beginning to show signs of congestive heart failure. And so he's told that unless he goes to a hospital, he only has a few days to live. And he doesn't want to go to a hospital because he says he can't shoulder the medical debt. And so the movie is basically him staying in his house as people come and visit him. It's actually based on a stage play by the guy who wrote the screenplay. And you can kind of tell because it's like all one location and people are coming in and out. By the way, the Academy Award was Best Makeup and Hairstyling, and also Best Actor. So
that's what I thought.
Yeah. But at any rate, like a lot of Darren Aronofsky films, this movie is like highly symbolic and heavily about suffering and faith and like how those things intersect with one another. Brendan Fraser's character, you find out fairly early in the film, has left his family years ago, like over a decade ago, because he came out of the closet as gay and started a relationship with the man. And that man was part of a church that is maybe just an evangelical church, but also seems to be a cult, maybe. That church basically, because of the typical kind of conservative Christian homophobic reasons, like, drove Brendan Fraser's boyfriend out of the church. And Brendan Fraser's boyfriend basically had, like, experienced such psychological trauma from that he killed himself. And that's kind of the beginning of Brendan Fraser's character's trauma. So a lot of the movie is dealing with these, like, really heavy themes about the connections between suffering and how that influences what you think about God and how you connect to other people. Brendan Fraser's character is this, like, outwardly very, almost like superhumanly magnanimous person in terms of his empathy and his ability to see good in people. His daughter, his estranged daughter, whom he makes contact with again because he's dying, is played by Sadie Sink, and she's basically like Damien, just like evil incarnate, just a horrifically sadistic character. But like the whole movie, he's just talking about how amazing she is, and how like it has this amazing capacity for good, and that's true of a lot of people. There's like a missionary who shows up and tries to convert Brendan Fraser, who's not interested in being converted. And
is that the Hong Chau character?
No, Hong Chau is his friend, who is playing a nurse, but it's not his nurse. It's a friend. Oh, it's actually the sister of his dead boyfriend, actually. And she is like kind of taking care of him out of the goodness of her heart, like coming in and checking his vitals every once in a while. And she's very good. She was also nominated for an Academy Award and did not win. At any rate, this ends up really being symbolic. You find out later in the movie that like the woman that Brendan Fraser left is named Mary, and so she's had a child. Mary has had a child, and so there's like that. There's like a really heavily telegraphed like a prodigal son reference later in the film. You find out that a character has like stolen money and run away from home and all this stuff, and it's just like full of this like all these biblical images, and is like at the end there's like explicit like spiritual stuff going on. I should
Darren.
Also mention
it, Darren it can't is, help himself.
He's gotta.
I'll get to this in a minute, but I love this about Darren. Like,
same.
There are very few filmmakers who are operating on that, like, on that register of like, I'm gonna make a movie explicitly about faith that's all like about symbols for the Bible and stuff. There are very few filmmakers doing that who aren't just like reactionary Christians, you know. And I love him for that. This movie didn't really work for me though. One thing that I have not really mentioned is, I did mention his weight. But that is a huge part of the movie. Because it's like killing him, like his sedentary life and his like problems with weight, like it's like a whole thing in the movie. I mean, the movie's called The Whale in part because there's a recurring motif of this like Moby Dick essay that he just loves and thinks is the best essay of all time and wants it to be the last thing that he hears before he dies, is reading this Moby Dick essay. But also, I mean, I think it, no matter what people say, I think it would be disingenuous to claim anything other than, like, The Whale is also referring to Brendan Fraser in this movie. And I don't know. There's been a lot of discourse about, like, the relationship that this movie has to, like, Brendan Fraser's, like, very heavily prosthetic body to be this man that's, like, hundreds of pounds. And, like, the movie is definitely playing up the grotesquerie of it and makes a spectacle out of it. And I think that that's kind of shitty. I don't know. It didn't make me feel good. And it's not meant to make you feel good, but it also, it's like a movie about empathy and the importance of connection with people, but it's also about like the body being a prison and causing material world, causing pain and all that. And it's just, I don't know. He could have had any other ailment. He could have just been physically sick with like a disease and it would have accomplished those themes. But instead he's a man whose size becomes this symbol. And it's just, I don't know. Maybe it works for some people. And Brendan Fraser is, like, pretty good. But, like, it doesn't really work for me. I don't know. Maybe other people it scans differently. But it definitely felt like there's an element of the movie you're supposed to be gawking at him. And I didn't really like that. I also as much as I love Darren and his Bible stuff, it didn't connect with me this time. Like, I'm a firm defender of Mother. Like, Mother is a great movie.
Yeah.
I love Noah. Noah is a great movie. Yeah. Like, I love it when he just goes whole hog into the Bible. But I don't know. It doesn't make sense in this movie. There's a bunch of, like, imagery and, like I said, like, symbols and references to the Bible. But I don't really get how they're supposed to add up. Like, Brendan Fraser is kind of almost this, like, messianic figure because he undergoes all the suffering, and that's, like, purifying in a way. But also, like, it doesn't... I don't know what I'm supposed to get out of Brendan Fraser being, like, a Christ figure. Like, it doesn't... It's not that it doesn't add anything to the movie, but I don't know where I'm supposed to go once I get that concept. And the same thing goes for, like, I'm not sure what's the deal with his daughter being just horribly cruel, mostly to Brendan Fraser, the whole movie, and then him just continually insisting that she's great and she's the best thing he's ever done, is having this daughter. And I don't know, like, there's a lot of choices in this movie, but they don't add up to me. And I'm sad to say that, because I want Darren Aronofsky just to keep making Bible movies. Like, that's one of my greatest, like, cinematic wishes. And this one just didn't connect with me, so that's my take on it.
They should let him, like, make a series, like, make more Noah-esque movies, but with just different, like, stories from the Bible.
Yeah.
Like, David.
I would 100%
have, like, David and Goliath.
Has there been a good one about the ladies that wanted to, they were offered to rip a baby in half because they both wanted it?
Solomon, dude, the Book of Revelation. Yeah. Imagine Darren Aronofsky unleashed on the Book of Revelation.
I know.
There you go.
I think he was just born too late. Like, if he was born in the right era, he would have gotten, like, The Bible by Darren Aronofsky, like, 20-part series.
You know that, like,
Charlton
Netflix
Heston,
or, like,
Charlton
Peacock
Heston's, like,
or something.
Nude in half the movie and stuff. It'd be crazy.
Yeah, he missed the Netflix wave when they were just, like, tossing money at just whatever. Like, he should have done it then and, like, made, like, a 12.
Yeah, he was, like, up to his elbows in Mother at the time.
Yeah, he should have just, like, gotten in with Netflix pretty early and made, like, a 12-part miniseries that was just The Bible by Darren Aronofsky.
I feel like the cast would be too sexy. Like, he would pick the sexiest Bible cast we've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to do that, though. Like, what's the point of having a Bible movie if you don't have sexy
that's
characters?
Like,
right. Very sexy, very white.
Yeah.
That's like the remake of Ben-Hur. I watched the remake of Ben-Hur, and Jesus in that movie is the most fuckable Jesus of all time.
Wait, I gotta see this Jesus.
I want to see that one.
You're just like, damn,
I
Jesus.
I like Ben-Hur.
All right, well... So, I mean, do you recommend The Whale? I don't really know what to do with The Whale, because I feel like...
Did you watch it?
No.
Did you see it at TIFF?
I didn't see it. I was going to go see it, but it didn't line up. But, like, I don't know if it's, like... It's, like, yeah, like, is it, like, Aronofsky, like, completionism? Like, I guess, what's the point? Now that we've passed the Oscars, like, what's the point of watching it?
If you're interested in Darren Aronofsky's thing, it's maybe an interesting, like... You might be interested in that because it has a lot of his thing in it. If you're like just kind of a fair weather Aronofsky fan, I don't think this is it for you. If you, I will say, you know, this movie has been buoyed quite a bit by the like Brendan Fraser Renaissance folks, and I don't know, Brendan Fraser's fine, but I've been mostly unconvinced by like us rediscovering him as like this hidden talent that, you know, he's got a lot of really awful stuff that happened to him in his life that I feel really sympathetic toward, but I don't like The Mummy's fine, like, you know, all the, but anyway, what I will say is I was surprised at how good he is like throwing himself into this movie. And if you're interested in like the Brendan Fraser Renaissance thing, or just seeing Brendan Fraser in a role that allows him very pointedly just like completely move away from his like kind of like affable like himbo past, I guess it's interesting on that level. I don't know. I just didn't think... It's like one of these movies... There's a lot of movies that aren't good, and they're not good because they don't take risks. And this is one of those movies that unfortunately takes like all the risks and is still not very good.
See, that's why I was kind of excited about it. I still want to see it because I am into like Darren Aronofsky at his most like unpalatably like... weird, and especially when it comes to the spiritual stuff. And I also was just like excited to see like a messy movie, in like an interestingly messy movie. Like, we get plenty of messy movies, but like, yeah, like, whoa, like going all these different places in a direction I didn't anticipate, you know.
If that's your mindset, like, that's probably a good reason to watch the movie.
Like, I don't anticipate liking it necessarily, but yeah, I am interested in the unfolding drama of his psyche.
The last thing I'll say is, like, you know, like, Mother, even if you don't like Mother, like, it's an experience that, like, you're just like, I might not like this, but it's an experience. And it's balls to the wall, like, just kind of crazy. This one doesn't really seem like that. It seems like you're very much...
This one is much more in the mode of, like, The Wrestler, or maybe, like, it's not like Black Swan in terms of content, but in terms of its relationship to reality, you know, where there's obviously symbolic stuff going on, but we don't really depart into complete allegory mode until maybe the last like 2 minutes of the movie or something.
And and doubly like frustrating because he didn't even write it, kind of, which is another reason.
Although,
I was like, maybe I won't go, I don't know.
I will say he didn't write it, but he found a guy in that screenwriter. Hold on, I'm gonna find the screenwriter's name real quick. Samuel D. Hunter. He found a screenwriter who apparently has all of the same hangups as him. Like, if you had told me Aronofsky wrote this movie, I would have believed
my
you.
My dude, yeah.
Well, The Whale, it's now streaming in different places. It's A24, so I forgot who A24 has a deal with now. It's one of the streaming services, so I would assume it'll pop up there at some point. But yeah, shifting from one Oscar-nominated movie to another Oscar-nominated movie.
Fathom.
I'm here to talk about Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, which was nominated for Best Animated Feature. This is the second in the Puss in Boots franchise, which is a spinoff of the Shrek franchise, which I know this podcast is on the record of as being, you know, strong fans of. And
or, me and Zach go back. We were there.
Yeah. Seth and I talking about Shrek 2 on our own, you know. We introduced Puss in Boots to the world, you know.
We did. We broke that shit.
We broke it. In this one, though, Puss in Boots is doing his thing. He's voiced by Antonio Banderas. He has a whole mishap, which the opening sequence of the movie, like the whole set piece that is set up to open the movie is pretty great. It kind of really displays the animation style. I will talk about this, I'm sure, in a minute with Michael, but DreamWorks has definitely started to kind of play around and get a little bit more interesting with their animation styles. You know, you have even stuff like The Boss Baby, How to Train Your Dragon, I'm blanking on it, but their most recent movie,
The Bad Guys,
that's it. Just are like kind of fascinating, fascinatingly animated movies, and this one is no exception. It definitely takes a lot from Into the Spider-Verse, but that's not necessarily a bad baseline to like work off of. But the opening set piece is really crazy. But at the end of that, he dies, which burns the eighth of his nine cat lives, and so he goes he goes through a little bit of an existential crisis. He goes and is in like this home for cats where he like has little mittens on, and they're doing the whole it's almost like One Flew over the Cuckoo's Nest or something. It's the whole thing.
He grows a big beard too, which is really interesting in terms of cat.
This is a big old cat beard. Then he's kind of thrust back into the action of being Puss in Boots when he finds out that there is a number of people looking for the mythical last wish, which Puss in Boots wants to use to restore his 9 lives. You also have Goldilocks and the Three Bears, who are played by Florence Pugh, Olivia Colman, Ray Winstone, and Samson Keo as like this like Cockney British family, which is like mafia family, which is kind of fun. And then you also have John Mulaney playing Jack Horner, you know, Jack Be Quick, who's like this evil capitalist trying to create this like pie empire, but also is like obsessed with magical items and like collects all these different things. And honestly, like a unhinged great John Mulaney performance, just really good in this as like this kind of side villain. But then the kind of main character, the main villain that you have is voiced by Wagner Moura from Narcos, and he is Wolf, but he's pretty much the personification of death.
And he's incredible. I love him.
Which is just this.
It is a great design.
He's genuinely scary.
He's super scary. It's really great. Just like this wolf with these two like kind of sickle scythe things, having the deliverance whistle going on. Like it's just like he's fucking great. But overall, like a really entertaining movie. I think it's kind of one of those, you look at it, you look at the title, you look at the, you're kind of like, oh, it's just a cheap Shrek spinoff, you know, just to kind of make some money. But like I said, like the animation itself saves it. It's not, the story kind of, you know, ebbs and flows. I think it's much more smarter than it probably is giving credit for. I think it has a little, like it's at least trying to get at some things that doesn't make it seem like it's some cheap spinoff of a popular franchise. I think it's actually trying to do something. And the animation itself makes it as something really engaging. Like there's a number of set pieces for, they have the beginning one. At one point, they end up in like this kind of mystical forest that whoever is holding the map for the forest, it like shifts to the different trials that each person faces. And so there's this constant like moving of color and scale and shape and landscape for whoever's holding the map. So you're constantly kind of going through the shifting motion there. But I really liked it. I thought, like I said, the voice performances are really good. It's frequently pretty funny. And I think, again, like much more than just kind of going, hey, let's just continue to bleed dry the Shrek franchise. If anything, it's kind of like this nice little jolt that, you know, if they are going to like jump back into the Shrek franchise, like I hope that they incorporate, some of the animation and some of the styles that they kind of, introduced in this movie, because I think that would be like a nice pairing between what Shrek's doing. But, Paige, I know you and Michael saw this movie. You have any thoughts on Puss in Boots, The Last Wish?
I saw it on Valentine's Day and I loved it. I was really mad because...
Good Valentine's movie.
I was mad about all the people that were bugging me to go see it because I was like, I don't want to see the sequel of a spinoff of a Shrek franchise. I just don't want to do this. And
I didn't either. I'm still scared.
I did not want to do it. But then, like, there was nothing happening for Valentine's Day. We had no plans. So I was like, I guess we're doing this. And it was great. I loved it. I thought it was phenomenal. I thought that the fight sequences were excellent. I thought it was genuinely very funny. I expected to hate this little dog character, Perito. Loved him at the end. He made me cry. I was just embarrassed by how emotional the movie made me. I'm completely in love with that wolf character. And I am not alone. I don't know why I did this. I don't remember what question I was looking for, but I looked up on AO3, which is the fan fiction website. Just curious what the most popular relationship in the Shrek universe is. And the most written about pairing is Puss in Boots and Wolf.
Shrek, just months after its release.
Shrek has been around for so long.
Dude, I thought for sure Shrek and Donkey. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, so.
Oh, I forgot the best character of this movie.
I was waiting on you to.
Which is a little grasshopper that I think is pretty much trying to be, or a cricket that's trying to be Jiminy Cricket,
so good.
But is named Ethical Bug. That the whole time is just doing an impression of Jimmy Stewart. that I personally love, because I also do unnecessary impressions of Jimmy Stewart that doesn't hit with the modern audiences of today. Then, you know, nobody's going, oh, Jimmy's
kids these days, they don't know James Stewart.
They're not going, oh, James Stewart from a plethora of Anthony Mann westerns. They're going, who, what are you doing, Zach? Like, what's going on? So I appreciated that there's just this unfiltered, amazing Jimmy Stewart impression that this bug has over the course of the movie. It's fantastic. Shout out to Ethical Bug.
He also gets some of the best jokes too, because he's like trying to be the conscience of Jack Horner, and so he's just increasingly disturbed at what this villain is doing.
He's constantly just going, what are you doing, Jack?
He's also not a voice actor. He was a production supervisor for the film, and he's like, you know what?
Probably did.
That's so good.
Let me in, coach.
He probably did a Jimmy Stewart impression, and they were like, screw it, let's throw that in there, which I love. That's the best story. Michael, what did you think of the movie?
I thought this was good. I mean, it was pretty funny. It was probably the funniest like Shrek adjacent movie since like Shrek 2, which is a low bar, but that's. It was actually a pretty funny movie. And, like, I love the animation. One of the things that's cool, like, that's kind of a very specific thing about animation, the animation that's cool is, like, there's a lot of stuff that is like Into the Spider-Verse, and like Into the Spider-Verse, it kind of drops some of the frames, so the... Because computer animation looks very smooth. That's kind of, like, the thing it does really easily. But then it'll drop frames, and it'll make it look almost like anime or something. And this movie in particular only... At least what I noticed, it only drops the frames when the characters start moving fast, like in the fight scenes and stuff. And so you'll have, like, you know, pretty, like, conventional animation in, like, the just dialogue scenes. And then when action starts, like, all of a sudden, like, the style just gets, like, very affected and, like, looks
comic
just,
book style.
Like, a lot cooler. Yeah, and comic booky or anime-like. And I thought that was very neat. Yeah, so I liked it for all of the reasons you guys mentioned, and the animation was neat too. But yeah, shout out to DreamWorks. I think they're the coolest in terms of animation, the coolest American animation studio at this point. They've been like knocking the animation out of the park.
Well,
like,
it's
since like Trolls. Or
well,
something.
It's tough too because I would say Pixar, but only like the Pixar movies that they're putting on Disney Plus only, because like Luca and Turning Red are fantastic, but they don't like put those in theaters for whatever reason. So I'm like, I like a little honorable mention to Pixar movies that are strictly on Disney Plus.
But even then, like, and I like those Pixar movies a lot, but in terms of like willingness to experiment and like kind of see like what animation can do when it's like not constrained by just kind of photorealism, but also still taking advantage of all the cool procedural things you can do with the computer. I don't know, they're really pushing the envelope in a way that even Pixar isn't. Like something like Luca looks very cool, and Turning Red looks very cool, but it only like kind of hints at the like really formal experimentation that like Puss in Boots does, which is weird to say.
That is weird to say.
I think also like. Outside of the bad guys, DreamWorks kind of has like these like they have these stable franchises. They have like Shrek, they have How to Train Your Dragon, Trolls is a franchise, you know, like they have these things that they know people will kind of. So I like also that they're going like, let's experiment with this, because they're just like, you know, people are probably going to show up to a Puss in Boots movie regardless. So I like that they're at least still like trying stuff and not just kind of, again, like phoning it in when they could easily just phone it in and make some money.
Well, because they were for a long time, like probably a solid decade in like between like 2003 and like,
well especially
2014 or something.
Yeah, especially like once you got the Shrek 3, I feel like How to Train Your Dragon's pretty strong, like across the board. But then they get in like Trolls and the Boss Baby and stuff like that. It just kind of becomes like retread stuff. But anyway, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, It's on Peacock right now. High recommend for animation heads if you're kind of looking for some. Again, there's cool stuff happening that's not just you know, Disney or Pixar or Sony. Like there, you know, some of the other studios are doing cool stuff also. But before we talk about some more animation, I'm gonna let Seth take us home with Fathom.
Oh, okay. All right, I'll keep it brief, because these are, I don't know why I'm talking about these necessarily. I don't think they're fantastic films or anything, but I just had a good time with the double feature of Fathom and Fantastic Voyage, which took place a couple weeks ago that I had. Fathom is a, it's the stuff that Austin Powers are made of. It's from 1967. You just see the poster and you want to watch it because it's got Raquel Welch and she's got a wild bikini on, and the font is really cool and it's blue, and it's just called Fathom, and she's a, of course, like a professional skydiver.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah. And like the opening sequence is this great, like, dreamy sequence where she's just like sunbathing and she's like falling asleep and she's slowly like stretching in this garden and like whips out this parachute like out of nowhere while the credits are rolling and just decides to like go skydiving and parachuting and stuff. And I don't even know how it all happens. It's one of those. It feels like a real stupid version of a Thomas Pynchon book, in that like it's got this like kind of wacky central character, bunch of wacky characters, and you just don't know how it all works. Because yeah, she's like accidentally tumbles into being a spy, of course. That is like a double agent being framed for murder by Russians, and then there's all these other factions that want this jewel that may or may not actually not be a jewel. It's maybe a nuclear device because it's the 60s, and all the guys that are trying to get the jewel like are battling her and stuff, and all the dialogue is really ridiculous. Like, it's all sexual tension. The whole movie is just sexual tension between the villains and Raquel Welch, and they're always just like, this kitty has claws. You know, that's just like all the dialogue is like that. And then she's like, sorry, tiger. And then she's got to press the detonator button, and then so much for that guy. But they're all like still like very turned on, even while they're like about to shoot her with a harpoon gun. Oh my God, my cat just tried to kill me. Yeah, so it's on YouTube, and it really does feel like one of the many movies that Austin Powers is maybe like lampooning or something. It is just like this nuclear bomb spy skydiver movie.
I mean, sometimes like you just want to watch something vintage and horny. Like, it's the only thing that will fill the void, you know?
Well, I'm looking in it. This one predates the Roger Moore James Bonds, which I feel like is kind of that's what that turns into.
Well, I guess, yeah, it's good you brought that up, because I guess it's a book like James Bond. I think there's like a series of books. It's like kind of like the female version of James Bond, like they were trying for or something, which I would have been down for a Fathom 2. To my knowledge, it did not happen. Or a crossover where she maybe kills James Bond and takes the mantle.
What a movie.
That would have been cool. And then, yeah, I was like, okay, well, I wasn't planning on watching that, but like, back to sci-fi, silly sci-fi movies from the 60s, so I gotta keep that going. Been wanting to see Fantastic Voyage for a long time. Pow! Raquel Welch is in that movie. Didn't even know. And, man, Fantastic Voyage is really wacky. I won't talk too much about that one. But it's just like, it's the original Like, we're going Osmosis Jones style into somebody's body. And for some reason, I by the end of the movie, you forget why they're even doing it. It's something important about, like, I don't know, curing some spy's brain. But
one of the spies from Fathom.
Yeah, there's like a mysterious... Yeah, it could have been. There's like a mysterious lack of music in the movie. It's just like absolutely haphazard. Almost feels like... Like, No Country for Old Men at certain points. Like, they're trying to, like, do something with the fact that it's just so quiet and awkward or something. Because, like, most of the beginning is just them, like, driving around in golf carts while being inside, which is a very, like, again, like, futuristic kind of Austin Powers thing. And they're just given the briefing. Very boring kind of conversation that is somehow like about this wild thing that they like discovered how to shrink people down and go inside people's bodies. But yeah, it's all kind of, it's very fittingly clinical. And Raquel Welch is kind of just like in the background being Raquel Welch. She deserved more in this movie, especially after what I saw that she could do in Fathom.
I haven't seen that movie in a really long time, but am I remembering correctly that like, they're injected into this guy via his like butt, like the something or like his thigh or something. They like, I don't know. Somehow that memory is there, but maybe I'm constructing
it's, it. It's something like that, but it's not like his butt. But I think yeah,
not like his butt hole, but like his the meat.
Yes,
you know?
I think they like probably say it really fast in a very technical way. But if you yeah, if you broke it down, it's probably his butt.
The butt meat. all right. Well, both of those are on YouTube, you said?
No, Fantastic Voyage. I had to library that shit.
Okay. Well, there you go. If you need a Raquel Welch double feature.
Yeah, or Dr. Loomis is also in Fantastic Voyage, so you got that. He's always like
from Halloween. Yeah.
He's always like staring out the window as their little submarine goes through the bloodstream, and he just says like, you know, like infinity in the grain of sand. You
that
know.
Sounds like something he would say. Yeah. all right, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna hang out with. We're gonna talk about some rats and science. We're gonna get more science, more animals, rats, etc. After this
more
break.
Magic amulets.
Dream by night, wish by day, love begins this way. Loving starts when open hearts touch and stay. Sleep for night. Lives are planned, future songs and flying dreams hand in hand. Love, it seems, made flying dreams so hearts could soar. Heaven sent these wings were meant to prove once more.
And we're back with part two of episode 445 of Cinematary. In this part, we're going to be kicking off our Don Bluth series with his first feature film, 1982's The Secret of Nim. Directed by Bluth, from a script by Bluth, John Pomeroy, Gary Goldman, and Will Finn, and based on the book Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim by Robert C. O'Brien. The film stars Elizabeth Hartman, John Carradine, Dom DeLuise, Derek Jacobi, and Hermione Baddeley. Mrs. Brisby, a widowed mouse, must move her children out of their home in a field before the local farmer starts plowing. Before the local farmer starts plowing.
But it's like, imagine the local farmer plowing being like this apocalyptic
yeah.
event.
unable to leave because her son is ill, Mrs. Brisby seeks the help of nearby rats who have heightened intelligence after being the subjects of scientific experiments. She receives an unexpected gift from the elder rat Nicodemus. Soon, Mrs. Brisby is caught in a conflict among the rats, jeopardizing her mission to save her family. In 1979...
They don't make them like they used to.
Yeah, it's such a silly plot when you read it. In 1979, Variety announced that writer-director-producer Don Bluth joined 7 animators and 4 assistant animators in leaving their positions at Walt Disney Productions to form Don Bluth Productions. The independent animation studio would produce its first feature film, a $7 million production of the 1971 Robert C. O'Brien novel Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, in association with Aurora Productions, the newly formed production company of former Disney executives Rich Irvine, James L. Stewart, and John Lang. A Wall Street Journal article published the same day reported that Bluth's animators left Disney after the studio passed on Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, as the studio already possessed film rights to a number of popular novels and had, quote, no incentive to buy or work on anything new. Bluth obtained the rights to O'Brien's novel in 79, and in 1980 moved from his home garage to a larger office space to begin searching for additional animators and voice talent. While they were still working at Disney, the Bluth Productions team members produced the 27-minute short film Banjo the Woodpile Cat as a side project to gain other production skills that the company and their animation program were not addressing. Bluth asked Ron W. Miller, Walt Disney's son-in-law and the president and CEO of the company at the time, to view Banjo, but Miller declined. As Gary Goldman recalled, quote, that pulled the enthusiasm rug out from under us. We had hoped that the studio might like what we were doing and agree to buy the film and allow us to finish the short film in the studio, which would allow us to recoup what we had spent in terms of money and the many hours that we and the other members of the team had invested in the film.
Have you seen that movie, Zach?
No, but the title is amazing.
Yeah, it's hit and miss, but it's worth a watch.
Okay. At the onset of production, filmmakers conceded that their biggest struggle would be finding a way to make rats appealing. Animation was estimated to cost roughly $80,000 to $85,000 per minute, and promotional materials revealed that the project would be filmed 4 times in its entirety, one in sketch form, one in rough animation, once in final pencil animation, and once in color.
Preposterous little furry things with tails. It can never be done.
The
They were really rat saturated. A lot of mice and a lot of rats.
The title was changed to The Secret of Nim, while the main character of Mrs. Frisbee was renamed Mrs. Brisbee due to copyright conflicts with Frisbee toy manufacturer Ramo.
Okay. Because I was always like, what do they think? Like, Frisbee's a silly name? Like, they're already making a silly movie about silly mice that talk. Like, it was just...
No, it's all... Big Frisbee got involved.
Big Frisbee got involved. Okay. Well, at least they weren't being cowards.
According to a December 29th, 1982 Variety article, Bluth raised The Secret of Nim's final $6.5 million budget from private financiers outside the film industry after investing $250,000 in the cost of his new studio. MGM, which had formed a merger with United Artists in 1981, quote, had no faith in the project and chose to release the film in a rollout campaign starting on the West Coast and moving east. Bluth was forced to independently raise $4.2 million through private funding for MGM United Artists advertising campaigns. In August 1982, LA Times...
Man, making movies sucks. Holy shit.
It does. An August 1982 LA Times article reported that Walt Disney Studios banned multiple film buyers and theater owners from booking The Secret of Nim as a double feature alongside the studio's Tron. Although Disney claimed that they preferred Tron to be paired with another Disney film, the article suggested that the company remained bitter over Bluth's departure from the company. Bluth indicated interest in bringing a lawsuit against his former employer, although the pursuit of any additional legal action is undetermined.
Poor Disney people.
In 1982, the New York Times said The Secret of Nim is a resourceful and valiant, though unsuccessful, attempt to revive the kind of animation feature identified with the golden age of Walt Disney, the era of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, Pinocchio, Dumbo, and Bambi, among others. 1982, Times said The Secret of Nim is more important as Don Bluth's declaration of independence on a form of... popular art that can infuse every corner of the imagination with its rainbow light. If Uncle Walt were to gaze on his renegade nephews, even he might approve. In 1982, Roger Ebert said, The Secret of Nim is an artistic success. It looks good, moves well, and delights our eyes. It is not quite such a success on the emotional level, however, because it has so many characters and involves them in so many different problems that there's nobody for the kids in the audience to strongly identify with. I guess you could say that the Disney tradition lives, but that the Disney magic still remains elusive.
I guess you can say Roger Ebert still drives me fucking crazy.
I guess you can say opinions can be wrong.
Yes.
On that note, let's talk about the secrets of the secrets. Secrets. There's only. It's not one secret. The secrets of NIMH.
There's many.
Wait, is it plural? I've been thinking this whole time it was singular.
No, it's singular. It's the secret of NIMH.
I missed the other secrets.
I'm just. There's a lot of stuff going on. You know,
I went right with you.
There's another secret. I don't know. There's a lot of secrets going on. Anyway, the secret of NIMH. I'm gonna start, Paige, since you're the most researched out of all of us. I'm gonna let you start.
Oh my god, I am over researched for this. So, I read or listened to the audiobook, Mrs. Frisbee. I read a big chunk of Don Bluth's autobiography and specifically read all of the Secret of NIMH section. Watched so many interviews, just read as much as I possibly could because I was obsessed. I was obsessed.
What's the name of that biography? I would love to read it.
It's called Somewhere Out There. And yes, and it's pretty recent. I think it's called Somewhere Out There. I might be. I literally downloaded it today and read it for like 3 hours.
Somewhere Out There, My Animated Life. Is that it?
Yes, yes. So I am like, I love Don Bluth. I've always loved him since I was a kid. And I always felt like any director where you can feel their personality, like in their work, like I've always admired creators like that. And I think he's definitely one of them. So his tale is a fascinating one. He was a farmer.
Who was plowing.
And he saw Snow White when he was a child, fell in love with it, was obsessed with animation from that day forward. That was his big dream, to work with Walt Disney. Walt Disney was his hero. Long story short, he moves through life, he gets that dream job, he works at Disney, and discovers that it's not as magical as he thought that it was going to be.
You learned the whole meet your heroes thing.
Walt Disney doesn't disappointment. It was the company that did, as they moved away from Walt's original vision. And they started.
Yeah, he was kind of there at like probably the shittiest time of all time to be in Walt Disney.
Yes, like just past the golden age, and that was what he fell in love with, was with traditional animation. So whenever they were getting popular, they started moving towards shortcuts. Like they didn't want to do small things at first, like they didn't want to animate reflections in the water. They didn't want to do original cast recordings in studio first. They wanted to have stand-ins, and then they wanted to animate and then have the real cast like kind of mimic what the like shitty voice actors, or sorry, the stand-in voice actors did before. And they didn't want to do a whole lot of like studying real models, and they wanted to do things like copy previous animated stuff so that they don't have to reanimate. So that's why you see a lot of Disney movies where the same exact animation is happening and you can kind of layer them on top of each other. They're doing shortcuts like that. And he was originally selected to be director for The Fox and the Hound. And so he had this old idea of what animation, to them it was old, of what animation looks like, versus all these young people that he was working with who didn't believe in this old way of doing things. They wanted to do the new way that saved money, that moved things faster. And he didn't, and he like tried his best to just convince everyone to keep the heart in it, but they didn't follow him. They villainized him for it. So He left, and these group of people followed him because they believed in his vision. And this movie this was their effort in keeping traditional animation alive. It was a passion project where they worked hundreds of hours in his garage to begin with, and then they finally found a place, and it was also a big fuck you to Disney. Like, yes, audiences will still resonate with this kind of animation. And you can just feel that. Like, he didn't shortcut anything. He didn't believe in shortcutted anything. So, I love it. And the entire thing is based off of a real place, the National Institute of Mental Health, where they performed real experiments on rats and mice, not for longevity and intelligence, but for overpopulation, like where they took rats and gave them unlimited resources to see, like, what overpopulation would look like and the effects, and compare it to how humanity could potentially look like. And so the book, and like, and eventually all the rats like lost their ability to mate because they had no reason to have any survival instincts because they were given everything by hand. And they all eventually killed each other. And so this book was made in response to that, saying that, like, in order to feel fulfilled in life, like, you can't steal and just get everything handed to you. You have to have education. You have to have the desire to build things for yourself. And so I don't know how much of the movie that translates into. What do you think, Momali?
I mean, the movie, like, the book, I haven't read the book since I was a kid, but I read it a ton as a kid, and the book is basically science fiction, with the only really, like, kind of magic being the fact that the animals can talk to begin with and stuff, or communicate. But the movie, like, the magical amulet and all that, that's not in the book at all, right?
No, it's not.
It kind of, but that kind of subsumes, like, there's, like, a flashback to the lab in the movie that lasts maybe 5 minutes, but the lab in the book is, like, a good chunk of the book, right?
It's a big substantial part.
The focus of the movie is a lot different. It's kind of more in this, like, almost, like, Watership Down, like, high fantasy kind of mode than the book, which is this kind of, like, weird, like, kids science fiction thing.
Yeah. The characters are a lot more subdued in the book. Like, Nicodemus is not this powerful wizard. He's just a guy. He's just a guy that was part of the lab group. And Jenner, one of the main villains of the movie, was also just a dude who was like, well, I want to keep stealing, though. Don't know why. I mean, we're not stealing a lot. We're rats. I'm going to go find my... I'm going to go do my own thing. And they're like, all right, bye.
What is it with rat media and stealing? Like, that's a big plot in Ratatouille, too. You can't steal.
But they're stealing, like, trash, so it's okay. Rats can steal.
Yeah.
Like,
rat liberation. We let them steal.
You're fine. I admire.
Because they might be forming a cyber tech magic civilization in a bush.
You never know.
With what they're stealing. So... shame on you.
I wonder if Don Bluth ever considered that his past as a farmer would have eradicated families of,
secret organization.
Rats in this movie.
He's like, finally, someone's talking about this.
Yeah, this issue, the real issue.
Seth, what are your feelings on Secret of Nim?
Well, I'm very happy to be amongst Nim heads. I wasn't sure
that's the per term.
If I would be.
That's the term.
But this is like one of my favorite movies, and it's always been. I just think it's so special. I watched it for the first time in a long time, like last year, I think it was, just like right when the leaves were turning. And it's like one of the best like fall movies. It just feels very fall to me. And I just couldn't believe how one of a kind it is. And it's a particular approach to things that you do see a lot in animation, like cute animals and even like, you know, fantasy and magic and adventure and stuff. There's just like a certain way it's all mixed and brewed that is very strange and striking, especially the way it is in dialogue with like 80s dark fantasy movies. Definitely like fits in there with like, you know, my dad showed me this alongside like Dark Crystal and like Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings and things like that, of these like... Yeah, it seemed like there was such an emphasis during this time on that darkness.
Dude, there's also an emphasis on this time with weird animals and that stuff, too. Like, Bakshi's got a lot of the weird animal stuff. And Disney had, like, the Rescuers and things. And there's, like, that movie from Canada, which I'm blanking on right now, but it's all about, like, a post-apocalyptic future where animals have, like, mutated into... like humanoid characters who are in a rock band. I don't know, there's something in the water with the animators like at that time period, with like there's like such a specific tone to a lot of the movies.
No,
around
for
that
real
time.
There's also just like a really nice sense of danger in this movie. Like it never, you know, like even like it starts out with that because, you know, even the very like basic task of Mrs. Brisby getting the medicine back to Timmy. But then like, you know, she gets intercepted by Jeremy and that whole thing is side plot with her, with him and Dragon. And then you think like she thinks that she's lost it and it like hits more because it's such a basic, like she just needs that to help her son. It's not like some it's not the fantastical part of the plot. But you have that, you have like the scene later on when she gets down to the place where the rats are and Brutus the guard like is like attacking at her, and there's just kind of like this sense of fear there. It captures that like sense of danger that a lot of you know what Paige was talking about, those movies that Don Bluth grew up on, really captured.
Yeah, that rose bush.
Well, and people actually die. Yeah. Like there's assassinations in this movie.
It's like a full-on sword fight. And yeah, I love how the rat sanctum, the like intelligent rats, is like, it is kind of frightening as a kid. It's like, this is not registering immediately as this is the good guys, like necessarily. It's like sparking like with weird electricity. There's like this guard rat who has like an electro staff and he looks terrifying. And
doesn't
it is
say
like,
anything.
True, because they are kind of interestingly were thrust into the middle of this like these kind of like they're trying to figure out what to do next. Like they're kind of like at each other's throats. They're splintering into factions. Which, yeah, it definitely points to, I don't know if it's the, like more of like what the author was talking about, but just like that maybe them becoming intelligent isn't all good either. That like this is like too much for them or they're advancing too fast. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, that's very lonely to no longer be a rat, but not be human either. Just something new and in between.
There's that thing where they talk about Mrs. Brisby's husband, Jonathan Brisby, who had been one of the lab rats, and they were saying that he was going to outlive her. Like she would have grown old and died, and he would have still been young in terms of the lab rat's life. And that's a very like melancholy, like almost scary.
Thinking about the ethical implications of that. Like he didn't tell her about his life at all and then had children with her who now have this extra lifespan, multiple children with her. And then he was killed. Are we allowed to spoil?
It came out in 1982. You're fine. We're about 20 minutes into this chat.
You should like, absolutely see this movie. Yeah.
Turn it off right now and go watch it and then come back. But yeah, so like she finds out that he was killed by Dragon like through this underground group of rats. Like she had no idea that this was his life, and she's just a mom. She's just a simple country little humble mouse mom.
Yeah, and that is very emphasized as well, the like family oriented aspect of our main character, like an unlikely kind of main character, like because there's really is like there's what is it, Justin, he's like you would expect
love
him
these
to be
rat
this
names by the way, Jonathan, yeah. Justin
the swashbuckling hero.
Hey, they're smart
right
rats
there.
So,
yeah, you know. Like he would be your hero at the center of the animated movie, but he's not. And even like maybe like okay, yeah, there's like the mother character, but the main character is maybe her headstrong young son or daughter or something. But it is like, and again, to its credit, man, I just disagree with Roger Ebert and how like he finds no emotional core or something really here. Like
this guy doesn't love his
like,
kids.
There's
doesn't
such
get
a
it.
Like that's very anchored in familial like purpose. I don't know.
I don't know. I definitely think there's emotion, but I do agree with him a bit on, because it's only an hour and 25 minutes, you do kind of get thrust into like the politics of the rat world very quickly. And like it becomes, you know, like, so then like, you know, again, like you start out with this very simple plot of the mom is trying to make her son has pneumonia. She's trying to get him well. They have to move because the farmer's coming. And then you kind of get thrust into like the politics of the Rats of Nimworld. You get thrust into like the mysticism of the world, and that all comes very, very quickly. And then like the rest of the movie is predicated on a lot of that stuff. And so while I still like the movie, I think that's where it does, at least in my opinion, it suffers a little bit, because it's very simple. Like, it's working, and then it kind of throws a lot of stuff at you all at once that I think complicates and convolutes the plot a little bit.
Yeah, I think go ahead, Paige.
Sorry. I felt like we were just kind of, because I mean, that is what happened to Miss Brisby. She was literally just like thrust into this new world and had to find all this new information, and it was supposed to feel overwhelming and like beautiful and mesmerizing and weird. I felt like that was what we were supposed to feel, like how she felt.
Yeah, and it's still like aesthetically, it still feels that way. Like visually, Don Bluth captures that for sure. I just feel like, you know, like the whole Jenner, you know, faction plot, a lot of that kind of stuff, I think would have flowed a little bit better if it was given a little bit more time. And I get why, like, you know, I mentioned the notes, you know, the money was getting tight and things like that. You weren't going to be able to make like a 2-hour long epic. But I do feel like some of that stuff gets just a little rushed. And so I don't think it gets less emotional. I think the emotion's still there. I do feel like some of that stuff could have gotten fleshed, because it becomes very, the whole politics of the rat world, I feel like needs much more time to kind of like sit in, rather than the, you know, 20, 30 minutes that we get.
I've had that feeling too. I remember the first time I watched this movie, which I was an adult, but I wasn't a very old adult. Like, maybe I was 20 or something like that. I remember being kind of disappointed, because the book is fairly clean in its storytelling, and it's like a really interesting little mystery. And then the movie gets convoluted, is the wrong word, but it like jumps over all this stuff. And it, I do feel like the pacing is weird in this movie. When I watched it this time, I kind of felt that same way. But one of the things that struck me now watching this with the plot is, how much this movie feels like it came from a very particular moment in like history. And like, Seth, you mentioned Thomas Pynchon in part one, and like, this is not a Pynchon-esque movie, but it kind of feels like it's coming out of the same kind of national psyche as like Gravity's Rainbow, or like even like what Inherent Vice is trying to capture like later on. This kind of like post-hippie idea of like kind of utopian groups kind of splintering apart, and like government experiments or government like kind of secret agencies having like kind of messed with communities, and like there's like a kind of paranoia around this sort of stuff that is like, I don't know, like there's something interesting about how Mrs. Frisbee, this like very like wholesome kind of domestic person, kind of falls into this society that at one point was utopian but is now splintering along like ideological lines. And like the way that it gets confusing is interesting in that context, because it like the movie is kind of losing the plot in the same way that the organization itself is, like where there's all this stuff and we're just thrown kind of in media res, like as like this group is, we don't really see the beginning of them that much except for a kind of bewildering flashback. And then we don't really know the future of them either. It's like this liminal transition point for like these groups. And I don't know, like I get, and I feel that the plot is not 100% satisfying in that regard, but I also think it's interesting how it goes about it. In a way that I think is kind of cool.
Well, especially like where Mrs. Brisby, like I kind of latched on this viewing to like the world that she's kind of coming from. Like you think of her whole plot at the beginning, like it's kind of a community that is very self-sufficient. Everybody's kind of working in tandem. Even Auntie Shrew, who like is getting angry at the kids, and like she's still a vital, like she's still somebody who's a vital role within the ecosystem that they're, you know, operating in. Like when the farmer's coming, like they're collectively going, we have to move. It, you know, it's not like, you know, they're not looking to leave anybody behind. And so yeah, you kind of have like this very like she's almost living in a very utopian setting that's very utilitarian, and then coming into another utopian setting. But that's just something that kind of stuck out to me this last, you know, when I was watching it the other day.
Man, that That voice cast is so exceptional. The way that they were describing it when they were making it is that they believed that when you cast for voices, voices and music add texture to the film, is what they said, texture. And I was thinking, like, that is the best way to put that. I think that all of them add such different flavors. And so a lot of these people would, like, go into the studio, and Don or whoever was there would watch them, and that would add the flavor to the character. Like, for example, John Carradine, the great Al, phenomenal performance.
Oh my gosh. Whenever, yeah.
One of the best characters.
Deep, great character actor.
They filmed that in what they considered like this very dingy, scary recording studio. I think they said it was Paramount, and so they were very surprised that it looked that way, so they were kind of spooked. And then John
that's so perfect.
John Carradine comes in, and he's the poor thing had arthritis, and he was shaking, and I think he had to do like one take because that's all he like could do with his medication in him.
He was coughing up little animal bones,
and he had this limp, and so they animated a limp with the great Owl. Yeah, so just so many things like that, like, painted the story as it went along, and I just think that adds so much. And I think the great Owl scene itself is like one of the most powerful scenes in the movie.
I love how that great Owl looks.
Standalone. Wow. Yeah, just the eyes. Because and is there? I'm always like wondering if there's something to that. That his eyes light up, and so do Nicodemus. They both have these like really striking, the way it's animated. Their like eyes are like laser beams coming out of their eye, like little sockets almost. And I don't know if there's like some part of the lore, and I think it's kind of left opaque, but like that there could be something there that like that's like a sign of wisdom almost or something. Nicodemus is like also like this mysterious, like he's made kind of creepy for being like the Gandalf character, only adding to like the grim fairy tale aspect of like, okay, like Mrs. Brisby like is trying to get help from someone, but like from Mr. Ages onward, it's just all like kind of like crotchety to absolutely terrifying to like, are you going to eat me? Are you going to help me? What is this kind of thing?
Well, that you know, going back to the amazing texture that the movie has, like, even though I have like, I feel like there's some shortcomings in the story department, like it's all made up with like the movie. You kind of just like to live and inhabit in that world for like the hour and a half. You know, it feels very, it's very fascinating in that sense, whether, you know, just the different set pieces that they go to. You just kind of have this like wide range of characters, like you're describing, these very like harrowing, omnipotent, like just kind of scary, you know, mage like characters with the great Owl and Nicodemus. But then you have like Dom DeLuise, you know, doing the crow voice and and things like that.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, like you just kind of have like this wide range. But you also just kind of feel like you have these very, like, they are really strong voice performances across the board, just because they feel very imbued in these characters. Like you don't feel like it's a, like, let's just toss in this, you know, star to like do this voice because there's some star power behind it. Like you feel like everybody's giving a performance that feels in nature of the character.
I love too, and because you touched on it, but I love the animation in this movie. It's so funny that and just like cathartic that Don Bluth left Disney and made this movie with like a ramshackle, like shoestring budget, because this movie completely eats the lunch of like any movie that like Disney released within a 5-year period on either side, you know, of this, like, and Disney had like all the resources and clout and stuff, but they were like diverting their resources to other things and letting their animation kind of wither on the vine. Like if you look at like, again, just like The Rescuers, which is a movie also about, well, not about rats, but about mice. Like, The Rescuers is animated very cheaply. It's got a lot of these same kind of moody textures, because that's a lot of, like, the kind of tone of American animation at the time. But it looks so cheap. It's so static. And, like, the they use like that kind of what is it called? Is it like a xerography or whatever? That kind of like sketchy little like 101 Dalmatian looking thing that Disney did for about 20 years, and it just doesn't. It looks like compared to this movie, like this movie looks so sumptuous, and I love too that this is a movie that is like a real like hand drawn. You know, it's got a real like kind of a homemade feel to it that a lot of early, well, not really early, but like pre like computer animation has, you know, where it's just got that kind of wiggly like kind of painterly feel to it that even
backgrounds,
like
backgrounds,
yeah, like the backgrounds are incredible, and just even the character animations, like both Don Bluth and Disney, like starting with. I guess Disney, starting with the Black Cauldron, and Don Bluth a little bit later, like started using like computers to animate stuff, to like ink things, and that makes the movies a lot slicker. Like Beauty and the Beast is a really beautifully animated movie, but it doesn't really look like old Disney movies because they're inking digitally. And Don Bluth did that too, and like most animators eventually did that because it's so much easier. And like I get why they do that, but there's like just a particular look that the like pre-digital inking has that is just incredible, and I love it. It makes sense that he likes all those old like kind of like pre-World War One or World War II Disney movies like Dumbo or whatever, because like those are when like the Disney animators like had every resource imaginable, and they created these incredible like moving painting movies. And this movie, of all of Don Bluth's movies, feels like the one that is like most reaching specifically for that vibe, that kind of like early Disney vibe, but also mixed with that kind of moody and dark like early 80s animation. I don't know. I love how this movie looks.
It's truly a crossroad moment. Like it is, and echoed in the plot, even how it works is like that it is still going for, which Disney was starting to go maybe more insular with their stories, like more like characters, like it's not like the end of the world or there's no like, you know, big huge climactic battle with a dragon at the end, but there is a cat named Dragon, and there is this sort of emergence of reality, and there is like a familial focus at the center of it, but there is also, they have swords, there's like this callback to like medieval, it does feel like it's like animation Armageddon or something. It's just like all this stuff from the past of Disney, and then all this stuff that's sort of like happening in its present. It's like all warring with itself, and it is kind of about to be kind of like the last of an era, sort of this sort of more reaching for a more epic, like wider in scope, less for children kind of movie. It's an odd movie in that way. It doesn't fit in very well. It's not something that, I don't know, I could see some parents kind of turning this off, like at least just out of just like, what is this?
And they Let's did
turn yeah it's,
during that absolutely. Time that was a major like issue, and that was part of why Don Bluth left Disney, was they would do these test screenings with children, like they did with the Black Cauldron, and in its original yeah. form, they were so disturbed by it that they just had to tear that shit up and try to make it less scary. And Don was like, hey, no, I like my shit fucked up, thank you. So he was just tired of this sanitization of, like, this fear of letting kids see dark things, of letting them see sadness, of letting them feel intense emotions. He didn't want that. And also, you can feel that in his movies. He's not afraid to let kids be a little bit fucked up after his movie.
Right, which yeah. still continues to be controversial and a hard thing to sell. Like, it still is, like, this sort of, like, divide of, like, half the people in the room, it seems, on these movies are like, okay, well, we're gonna make a quick buck off some kids with some funny animals. Then the other half are these like Don Bluth types who have, yeah, like kind of like unexpected wild ideas and like a different sort of attachment to fantasy and like animation and cartoons. Even they're not seeing them in a childish way, but like they have kept them with them through adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about Laika a lot, and I feel like that's a good, but I feel like in terms of really separating themselves and like finding a firm like vision within their work is something like Cartoon Saloon, and especially like the work of Tom Moore. Like that feels like it can be very cutesy, but I feel like at the same time it really has like an edge to it. There's parts in Secret of Kells and Wolf Walkers it's not cutesy. Like it can be pretty scary. There's that kind of fear of danger imbued in it. And I feel like while watching Nim, I was thinking a lot about Wolf Walkers and some of the Tom Moore animated movies.
Yeah, and at the same time, like, there's something special about this movie in particular, because, like, Don Bluth has, like, dark, melancholy stuff throughout his movies, especially, like, his 80s movies, like An American Tale and Land Before Time. But, like, there's something, a lot of those movies don't hit the tone that this aspires to. Like, this aspires to, like, a very particular tone that's kind of, like, demographic agnostic. You know, like, most of Don Bluth's movies are very solidly, like, within a demographic. And it's mostly for children, but it's, like, for kind of children who are maybe going to be scared a little bit by it. Or maybe, like, with Titan A.E. or Anastasia, a little bit older.
Nah, Pebble Penguin is fucked up, man. You gotta read between the lines.
But, like, I don't know, like, there's something about this movie that, like, it feels like it's for the kind of person who, like, by the end of the 80s would have been starting to get into, like, anime and like the Studio Ghibli stuff that would have been starting to be imported to the United States by this time. Yeah. Like, it's got that kind of like a Nausicaa or something like that vibe, where like this could clearly appeal to children, but there's something about the way that this is made that is kind of like indifferent to whether or not it is children watching it. And I don't like, I like some of Don Bluth's other movies, but they're not really like this. Like, this is like kind of stands out in his movies in terms of like the kind of movie that it is, and I dig that too.
No, it truly feels my thing about this movie, it always feels like something that we would just only be able to read about, and we'd like see stills from, or like concept art. Like, Don Bluth was gonna do this crazy like cyberpunky fantasy, like gritty, yeah.
It's like an Orson Welles movie.
But like somehow yeah. He did it, and it was like the first one he did. Like it's kind of wild that we live. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not good.
Like
out.
Orson
Welles.
I guess
that's true. Yeah.
Don Bluth, the Orson Welles of animation. Any final thoughts on Nim before we wrap up?
I do want to I want to throw out some of the stuff that Don Bluth did around this time. That's kind of interesting too, because Don Bluth was, I don't know exactly where he got his money, and he didn't have a lot of money compared to, like, Disney, but, like, he got a lot of projects, like, some of it at Disney. Like, he did this, his stuff at Disney is kind of saccharine in the way that, like, a lot of, like, Disney shorts are, but especially that one Banjo, the Woodpile Cat, like, definitely feels like Don Bluth doing his thing, where it's got, like, weird kind of dark stuff in it, because it's, like, this cat that runs away from home, and gets kind of caught up in city life. It's kind of like Oliver and Company, if you've ever seen a Disney movie, but it's got like a little edgier stuff in it. And then he did this like Christmas movie called The Small One. That's about the donkey that that Joseph and Mary rode to Bethlehem. And like this donkey is like just ostracized because he's like a runty, like the runt of the donkey litter, or I don't know how donkeys give birth, but he's the runt, and a bunch of the movie is him trying to be sold, and no one wants him, and then finally Joseph like takes him, and he takes Jesus, or takes Mary to give birth to Jesus or something.
Jesus in a way is coming too,
and like in both of those movies are kind of weird and sad, but also very sweet and saccharine. And the other thing that he did around this time that was kind of interesting is he got into video games. The Dragon's Lair. Yeah. Has anyone played Dragon's Lair? It's not a very good game, but the cool thing about it, it's basically a game where everything is QuickTime events. But the hook of the game is that it's an animated game. Like, it looks like an animated movie, and you're like a knight that has to rescue this princess, Princess Daphne.
You're just activating scenes, basically, to watch, you know?
Right. And this, you played it in arcade, so if you missed your QuickTime event, you lost your quarter. It was a real scam, but, like, the animation is kind of cool. Like, I don't know, it's like a precursor to, like, the kind of CD-ROM games in the 90s, you know? It kind of has that vibe to it, but with cool animation from Don Bluth. So anyway, like, all...
I was texting Michael yesterday. I was, like, looking up stuff on Dragon's Lair, and allegedly Ryan Reynolds is trying to make a Dragon's Lair movie right now, which sounds like just, like, you're like, oh, Don Bluth resurrected, but then it's like, oh, Ryan Reynolds...
It's not gonna work.
It's like that. It's like that Simpsons scene where like Homer is buying the doll, and he's like, "This is a doll. Oh, that's good. It is cursed. Oh, that's bad." And like it keeps going back.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. Like Don Bluth's interesting. Like especially this kind of like crossroads Don Bluth is kind of interesting because he's got his like fingers in all these like different projects, and I don't know. It's neat.
Yeah, I love these striving for something that doesn't quite fit in, and again, like it's almost like he knew like where we were headed with mainstream animation, and he knew he had to do it while he could, which I do think while there's like really great stuff that happens, we are like as far as English speaking audiences are concerned, like, you know, it seems like it's still barely like we're still barely able to sell Studio Ghibli stuff, like, you know, sometimes, let alone something that's more, like, dark or even for adults, like in mainstream cinema, things like that. And I think this was, like, maybe a stab at that. And in the same way that maybe, like, the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings was, or Plague Dogs, Watership Down, even, which we compared it to. I just adore this movie. It'll always be so special to me. There's just like, I don't know, like plot aside, there's just something about, I don't know, the raw aesthetic, the vibe, the, I don't know, leaves and reds. Oh, I also wanted to ask you guys about like magic and what is magic doing in this, like, how do we get to magic? Like, I know it's like because it's probably reaching for this like other part of Disney that he loves, but it is like this, it's a techno rat thing. Like they are into electricity, and they've like advanced to that level, and they're like super brainy, but like it's almost, I've always wondered if like that's part of what's going on here, is like that the rats have gone even further than we have or something, because there is like levitation, there's like borderline like weird Tesla stuff, and then they have the magic amulet like that can do crazy like magic stuff.
I fully believe that a lot of the deal with Don Bluth is he wants things to be felt, not understood a lot of the time. If he's like, you know what, I want you all to feel mystified, that's the goal. I'm not going to put a cool reason behind it. There it is. You guys feel like mystified walking into this cave? Then I did it.
And it's left for us to wonder about, which I like. Mm-hmm. I like that it's not necessarily touched on, because, yeah, that would only bring down an already like kind of over the children's head kind of movie.
Or he would think, like, this would be fun to animate. I'm going to do it. Like, putting some sparkles on some shit for no reason. I'll do that.
He loves putting sparkles on shit. Mm-hmm. There's so many sparkles in this movie. I love it.
Yeah, I don't know. I just love that idea that's in here that, like, they went through technology towards something that looks like magic, I guess, which is, just kind of awesome.
I feel like that, like, especially at the time, like, if you read a lot of, like, science fiction or like that sort of, there's that idea about like the kind of blurring of the lines between like sci-fi and fantasy, because you get like
steampunk,
like Arthur C. Clarke, like sort of thing, where like, you know, alien technology is fundamentally like magic, and like even like the Bakshi stuff, like Wizards, have you ever seen Wizards? It's like that kind of thing where it's like this high fantasy imagery, but they've got like machine guns and stuff. I don't know. like I said, like, there's something going on with, like, all the American animators at the time. They're all preoccupied with the same stuff. I don't know.
Paige, do you have any last thoughts before we wrap up?
I guess that they literally don't do it like this anymore. This is a real treasure. It's very, very special.
Well, if you haven't seen Secret of Nim, hopefully we've convinced you.
There's still secrets, even though...
There's still secrets.
Yeah, we didn't give them all away.
But I watched it on Canopy. You can watch it on Canopy. I think it's on Amazon Prime. It's on Tubi. Shout out to Tubi.
Yeah.
It's a good... If you're kind of wanting to, old classic Disney fan, but wanting to kind of see something off the beaten path, this is definitely one to check out. That'll wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we list all the movies that we talked about in this episode. If you'd like to support the show, head over to patreon.com/cinematary. Big thanks to our patrons, Cam, Chad Newsom, Candace Sisson, Ron Hayes, Teresa Marsathi, and Tyler Chandler. We appreciate your support. Next week, we're going to be continuing our Don Bluth series with 1986's An American Tale as we scale through the Bluth filmography. Until then, thanks y'all for listening.